So thank you for coming, and thank you to the organizers for having this paper here. This is work with Tamara and Courtney Van Houtven. And Tamara did a great job explaining the long-term care insurance industry in the U.S., and so I don't have to, which is means that I'll be quick. So what we wanted to look at here is looking at long-term care insurance, really looking at it from a married couple point of view instead of just at the individual level. And we want to acknowledge the NINR, the National Institute of Nursing Research, for their funding, and amazing research assistance from Jillian Bowles, who this is sort of an additional paper that came out of some early work on this grant, and we wouldn't have even tried to write another paper if it wasn't for Jillian's effort. So we owe her big. Okay, so, you know, the long-term care is a large risk. We all know this. So it's a slight variation in statistics. I have 15% of Americans 65 and older have long-term care insurance currently. There has been attempts to increase the private market. Like Tamara said, there's been tax deductions and credits. The long-term care insurance was included in the Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, which has been since repealed. The private market itself is not doing great at the moment, where premiums are increasing and underwriting is tightening. And so there's sort of this question of what are we going to do? Medicaid and Medicare have budget constraints. Individuals have budget constraints. How are we actually going to expand, if we want to expand, the long-term care insurance market? There's been a lot of research on purchase. Theoretically, it makes sense to kind of think of it in a family context. So both, you know, why would you want to buy long-term care insurance, or perhaps why you may not want to buy long-term care insurance, right? Maybe it's you don't want to buy long-term care insurance because you really want your kids to provide care for you. If it's free, they'll put you in a nursing home, like Tamara just found. And so maybe there's a demand story that, you know, you don't want to buy long-term care insurance, but it's really a family decision that parents are making. And maybe they want to keep some money around and not pay all this money in premiums, keep the money around to bribe their kids and to evoke care from them. And purchases are happening when people are married. They're 65 on average. So they're happening in a sort of two-person household context. But it's unclear, you know, right now there's empirical support of these different theories is pretty mixed right now. But they've all focused on an individual decision-making process. So, you know, do I buy long-term care insurance? You know, which makes sense in the fact that in the U.S., most private long-term care insurance policies are sold at the individual level. Sometimes you can get riders so that you can get share benefits between a married couple. But most are actually sold on the individual purchase. But the decision-making might not actually be happening at the individual level. And so maybe it's just that there's this disconnect between the decision-making and the actual product that you're buying, and that's why we're not actually seeing great empirical evidence for the theory that we have. So like I said, you know, most purchasing are among married couples, you know, but we know very little currently about long-term care insurance purchases within the couple. And so that's really what this paper started as, was sort of a descriptive paper just figuring out what the patterns were, and then try to figure out maybe if we can explain why it's happening, what the purchase patterns look like, and can we explain the patterns that we find, and then whether or not we can think of it as a rational decision, right? And so, you know, if you wanted to think about buying long-term care insurance, you know, there's a few things you have to take into account. First is going to be the price, right? So long-term care insurance is not cheap. So if you're buying at around age 60 in 2000, a three-year policy, $150 a day, so it's not the most generous policy on the face of the earth, right? On average, you're talking over $3,000 in premiums per year, right? And that, you know, I think Tamara had the poverty line, a third of the elderly in the U.S. are under making less than $22,000. You know, a third, $3,000 may be a lot. If you double that to insure both members of the couple, you know, that's, you know, a sizable portion of people's retirement income. And so maybe just the financial constraints are too great, and so you may not be able to afford two policies. And so maybe then you wind up insuring only one and not both. Other things you need to think about, so if you don't want to buy two, who are you going to buy the insurance for, right? So if you do the math, you know, you want to look at the people whose higher probability of spending the most money. That's the person who you should insure. But first you have to figure out who that person is. So who's a higher probability of using long-term care, and who's going to cost the most if they do use long-term care, right? So on average, because premiums are actually usually identical between men and women, and women live longer, and we outlive our spouses, and we use long-term care more, on average, you'd expect to see women buying it more often in a couple, if you went with that logic. We actually don't see that, so... we also have to take into consideration that the financial cost of disability may actually depend a lot on what the state of your spouse or your family are when you actually become disabled. So if my spouse is super healthy, they can take care of me. It's pretty cheap, right? So maybe I don't want to actually insure the person who's going to be sick first because I have a cheap form of spousal health insurance. Or spousal informal care to private insurance. And it may be the case that maybe other informal caregivers are important as well. So if I know that my kids are going to live nearby, or my kids aren't going to be working, right, then maybe it might be less likely to provide it, buy insurance for the person with the kid nearby. This becomes especially relevant when you talk about divorces in the U.S., which is very prominent, number of kids who are stepkids versus biological kids. And so we can actually use the HRS to try to tease that out, since you're more likely to give informal care to a biological parent than to a step-parent. So these are all things that we're trying to kind of figure out what's going on in terms of why people might be insuring one or the other person. There also might be some idiosyncratic considerations, you know, maybe differential decision-making power within the couple. If you're only considering yourself and you don't care about the other person or what happens, that's going to be kind of tough to insure the other person. Or they may just have differential propensity to plan, so you may not be able to really forcefully say, I really want to be insured because you can't think beyond tomorrow. And we actually have measures of this in the survey, so we can use some data to try to tease out some of these idiosyncratic considerations as well. So what we use is the Health and Retirement Survey, same thing as Tamara used, and sister to Elsa and Cher. So we have people of 50-plus non-institutionalized population, use the same long-term care insurance purchase measure that Tamara used. So basically looking at people who didn't have long-term care insurance in the base year, 2 years later they do say yes. We merge this with the geographical data in order to then merge it with the state tax data, similar to tomorrow's paper, to look at differential. Basically, we can use state variation in essentially the price because we have these tax incentive differences. So we want to make sure, in order to be looking at these changes, we make sure that you're married and still married so that you're not looking at changes in household composition during these time periods, which may be changing the long-term care insurance question or your decision about long-term care insurance. So you have to answer both the long-term care insurance question and stay married to the same person, and that person has to be interviewed in the HRS as well. Seems logical. In the base year, like I said, we're looking at purchase, so no one has it in the base year. And again, these are very similar restrictions to tomorrow's, where basically you want to be people who could buy long-term care insurance. So they don't have a lot of previous days in nursing homes. They're not going to be eligible for long-term care through Medicaid or the VA system, not currently disabled or cognitively impaired. So we wind up with 4,700 couples, 13,000 observations. So the first kind of question is, what do the patterns look like? So if at least one member of the couple is eligible, this is looking at the first time someone buys, you know, you see 91% don't buy, not surprisingly, but about equal percentages actually buy for either the man or the woman. So 2.2% purchase for the woman only, and 2.1% purchase for the man only. So this kind of goes against the idea that, you know, if on average women use it and they're going to cost more, then we should be insuring for the woman. They don't seem to be doing that. And we've looked longitudinally, and if you're not buying for one person instantaneously, it's not like there's a lag and that the other person catches up eventually for the most part. So these are pretty stable over time. And the other thing to note is that it's not just an eligibility question. So if we limit to the sample to just the sample where both members of the couple are actually eligible to buy long-term care insurance, we get virtually the same numbers, right? So it's not that the people buying for the man only are buying because buying only for one because the woman can't qualify, right? Even in the case where both qualify, still 2% are buying for the men and 2% are buying for the woman only. So the first sort of interesting, I think, result is that it's not actually sort of what you'd expect in terms of, on average, we should be insuring the woman. So then we wanted to see what exactly is influencing these purchases. Is there anything about, you know, family structure or tax incentives or demographics that really explain these purchasing patterns? So we have a bunch of information about demographics and about the family and the couple. Right, so we have different covariates for the man and the woman within a couple. We look at age. Parental health is perhaps a signal of what your own aging trajectory will be like. Whether or not you provided informal care to a parent, again, maybe testing your ability or willingness to be an informal care provider yourself. Whether you've been working after the age 50. Your education, interesting one is whether or not you actually enjoy spending time with your spouse. There is a question like that, and people say no. I kind of alluded to this earlier. We have some family characteristics, whether or not you have biological children, whether or not your spouse has biological children, whether or not they're the same, right? So maybe different because of stepchildren. And we also know a little bit of information about the demographics, whether or not they're living with you or whether or not they're living nearby. And then we have some couple resources, sort of the economic resources that you would expect, differences in age, differences in health. We do have questions on the family decision maker. You can answer the man or the woman, or sometimes the men and the women disagree when they're asked. And so we have a discordant group where you ask both the man and the woman, and they both think that they're the decision maker. This is really just correlations, right? So that we're not getting at causality here. This is really just trying to look and see what might be influencing these purchase decisions. So we have a couple different models. You know, one is looking at the long-term care insurance, whether or not you buy none, one, or two, right, in the simplest model, or look at sort of no one, the man, the woman, both people. In the model, and so we estimate that with a multinomial logit, and we have both these samples where they're both eligible and at least one eligible. And I'm predominantly going to show the both eligible model. They're not actually all that different, the results between the two, and I think that kind of clears up at least some of the concerns that you're only buying for one because the other person can't buy it. So what are our results? So you're more likely to buy for anyone. If you're a planner, or if someone in the household is a planner, that's not shocking, but it's kind of, you know, given all of the other controls, it really is. If you can convince people to plan, they're more likely to plan for the future and do something like buy long-term care insurance. You're more likely to buy for both when you're rich. Not surprising. Financial constraints bind for the rest of us. The relative age seems to matter. So the older the man is relative to the woman, you're more likely to buy for both. If the woman's parents are sick in poor health, you're more likely to buy for both. And if you don't have any children living with you. This seems relatively intuitive. But why would you buy for one? When you buy for one, sort of what is it? Why is it that you're buying for the man or versus the woman? Right. So if you buy for the man, sort of he has a middle-income child. When he does not enjoy spending time with your spouse, you don't buy for the man. So if he's curmudgeonly, you're not sure for him. If you have young children, you buy for the woman, young co-residential children. If your wife, or if the woman provided informal care to the parent, so there might be more likely to then provide informal care to the husband, you are more likely to buy for the woman. And same with the husband. So the husband providing informal care to the parent, you're less likely to buy for the woman. And maybe that's a sign that the husband's actually going to be willing to buy informal care to the wife, so you don't need to insure against that. And so not all of these, but at least some of these, you know, do sort of suggest that the importance of the informal care supply are going to be important factors in deciding which one you're going to wind up insuring when the budget constraint actually seems to bind and you can only buy for one. So finally, we wanted to kind of see, you know, is this rational, this decision? You know, do they get it right? And so we wanted to look at people who, they were both eligible, but only decided to purchase for one couple, for one member of the couple. And we look at basically outcomes after the time of purchase, you know, up until 6 years after the time of purchase. And we define these outcomes as sort of, you know, whether or not you became disabled, whether or not you died, with a proxy of saying, you know, you aged faster and worse, perhaps, than your spouse. And then look at sort of disability after your spouse dies. So do you have a disability after you no longer have in-home informal care available? Or disabled after the spouse dies, again, with the idea that you no longer have informal care in your house. And so we wanted to see, you know, are people who buy long-term care insurance more likely to have any of these things happen to them? Again, this is not causal. This is just correlations. But actually, we find no correlation at all. So we don't find any evidence that the long-term care insurance is more likely to be disabled first. So we're not insuring against the spouses providing informal care. But you're also not more likely to be the person who's disabled last or disabled with no informal care. So you're not necessarily insuring against kids providing informal care. They seem to be basically insuring at random. You know, we know that the supply factors seem to be correlated with what their decision to buy, but they don't seem to be better than anyone else at predicting who's going to need actually use the long-term care insurance. So the bottom line, I think, is that the purchase patterns don't really meet the prior expectations, or at least not exactly, as far as you know, who you'd expect to buy long-term care insurance. Regardless of eligibility status, you're just as likely to buy for a man as a woman, and you're only very slightly more likely to buy for both than just for one person of the couple. The spousal ineligibility does not drive differential purchase patterns, which I think is the first thing that, you know, first time I saw the data, that was sort of what we all just kind of hypothesized. It's, well, George can't buy it, so we're still going to insure Mary. But it does not seem to be that case at all when you actually kind of dive into the data. And it's really sort of wealth and availability of informal care seems to be influencing purchases. And it doesn't seem to be that they have, like, insider information or they're getting it right in terms of who to insure when they're only insuring one member. There may be some other measures we should be looking at, but it's not that they're more likely to be disabled first or more likely to be disabled after the spouse dies. So that is our results. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? I was crystal clear. Never.
I just wonder if you have the age difference between the couples.
Yeah, we controlled for the age of the woman and the age difference between the man and the woman, and that was the older the man was, the more likely you were to buy for both. Yeah.
Just a question on institutional on premiums. I mean, is it illegal to differentiate premiums between men and women?
It is not illegal, but for the most part, they don't do it. When I've talked to insurance companies about it, they feel like it's a hard sell to sit in front of a couple and say you're going to cost more than your spouse. And so despite the fact that it's not illegal, that's what the reps have told me when I've talked to them.
But that is changing generally.
Yeah.
Now it's charging more for women, and they're about a third of the market. So.
Well, it's obviously important to the income effect here, and, you know, the prices don't make a huge difference, and, you know, you generally know that the lifetime cost will be that higher, so
right.
If that gets reflected in premiums, that could change it.
In Europe, it's not allowed.
Yeah.
Those correlations you showed at the end, were they standardized correlations, or were they a predicted effect, you know, all things equal, or was it just the observed?
Those are the observed. Those are the marginal effects, yeah. All right. Well, thank you.